The Tom Woods Show, episode 1984.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, creating an online course can be an excellent way of establishing yourself as an authority. It's also a great first product. And if you know what you're doing, it can generate you some real smackers. But how do you do it? Well, I have a teensy-weensy bit of experience with online courses, and I've put together some material that takes you through step-by-step exactly what to do and then how to market that course so people find out about it and buy it. Get these free resources at tomwoods.com/makecourses. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Joe Salerno is our guest today because we're going to be talking about Ludwig von Mises. And Joe is academic vice president of the Mises Institute. He's professor emeritus of economics at Pace University and editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And we're going to talk about Ludwig von Mises, as I say, but in particular because we are within roughly the week or so of Mises' birthday. And it seemed like an opportune moment to revisit the topic of Mises. Of course, we talk about Misesian economics on this program all the time. But I wanted to talk to Joe, who's written a lot on this subject and lectured a lot and knows a lot about the history of economic thought, just about the importance of Ludwig von Mises, and also talk about some, let's say, contemporary issues that have been controversial in the discussion of Mises. So, Joe, welcome back to the show.
I'm glad to be on, Tom.
I'm a little bit slow sometimes when it comes to birthdays. Your birthday, I don't think I've ever remembered, but Mises' birthday, I like to try to be on top of things like that, like Rothbard, stuff like that. And I just missed it this week. I was like a day or two late, but better late than never. I mean, this is the week or the month when Mises would have turned 140, were he still here with us. And a lot of people were talking about him on that day. It's very important. But I thought, why not talk a little bit about Mises with the academic vice president of the Mises Institute. And I was just telling my newsletter subscribers that, you know, for all the obscurity in which Mises worked, you know, with his unpaid position at NYU, the fact remains that nobody today could tell you a single faculty member in the NYU economics department in 1967. You know, I mean, maybe you could because you specialize in this, but I have no idea who was on their faculty, but we do know the name of Mises. And that means something.
Absolutely.
So we can talk about his non-economic opinions, which are also interesting. But is there a way you can explain to a layman, different from how you would explain to a fellow economist?
Yes.
What is it that makes Mises' contributions so important? I mean, obviously, you could talk about this for a long time, but it's not just that he believed in the free market. I mean, forget about the ideology. His economic analysis, why is it an advance? In what ways did it represent an advance?
It represented an advance in the sense that he was able to draw out how economists, really from the beginning of the science, actually went about constructing economic theory. And he called that praxeology, which is a fancy term for the study of action. So in other words, he realized that anything that economists said that was true, you could trace back to the fact that individuals acted, that they applied means consciously to achieving ends in their lives. And step by step, he built this up to show that when it came to action in the marketplace, this crucial insight and a few other basic empirical truths about the world, this crucial insight allowed you to deduce how prices were determined, how everyday prices that we pay in Walmart, Quick Check, and so on, how they came about, and how not only were they a mundane phenomenon that we, you know, that we would observe every day, but how even deeper the entrepreneurs, the businesses, use those prices to calculate what goods to produce, or at least to forecast what goods were going to be profitable in the future and what would lose money. So a whole structure of economic theory was built on the insight that people act deliberately, that they behave with a purpose.
Now, let me follow up on that, because the emphasis that you just placed on prices in the here and now that we see, as you say, in Walmart or in any store in our day-to-day lives, it would probably come as a surprise to most people that focusing on that is itself an advance. But I think a lot of people assume that is what economists do. But economists, whether we're talking about, you'll have to correct me, but the classical economists who preceded Mises, and a lot of economists today, when they talk about prices and price theory, it seems like they're talking about, well, here's where the price will be in long run equilibrium or whatever. But, well, what about the price today that I just paid for this ham sandwich? What about that price? Where is that in economic analysis outside of the Austrian school?
Yeah, well, that's a good point, because Mises and the Austrian school before him turned economics on its head. So their whole point was that, well, the prices that we're really interested in are those prices that develop in the long run, or that are equilibrium prices in which, you know, things stop changing. But for Mises and the Austrians, it was really the exact opposite. The real prices are the prices that are fluctuating moment to moment on the stock market, and even in stores, I mean, you know, discounts and so on. They're continually changing. And those are the prices that we need a science to explain. These other prices, the long run price, equilibrium price, they're just aids in our thought. They're not something that you need to worry about as a business person or as a consumer. Okay. These people are worrying about the real prices that they're either receiving or that they're paying.
Now, I wonder if this has to do with why it is that when we read Mises or Rothbard or any of the major names in the Austrian tradition, there's so much emphasis on the entrepreneur, when among other economists, the entrepreneur, either they have a quirky definition of entrepreneur, or a very narrow definition, or the entrepreneur simply drops out of the picture, because it seems like if you're focused on so-called long-run equilibrium, the work of the entrepreneur doesn't matter, because the entrepreneur is moving prices closer and closer to, of course, a long-run equilibrium that we'll never reach. But if we're already at that long-run equilibrium, there's nothing for the entrepreneur to do.
Right. He has absolutely no function in modern economics. So, you know, in the economic textbooks that we're still teaching from today, the entrepreneur is almost never mentioned. You have business firms that more or less, you know, calculate and set marginal revenue to marginal costs, and they know their demand curves, they know their cost curves, and so on. But entrepreneurship is precisely what's needed to figure out what those cost curves are, what demand by consumers will be for different goods in the future, not only 2 days in the future, but up to 5, 6, 7 years if you're planning out the building of a new facility.
If I were to try to think of in what way does the work of Mises, is it most valuable to the average person? Like what particular insight is potentially the most helpful for the average person? I would think, because it's both theoretical and immediately practical, the business cycle theory. Because of course, if you can avoid the business cycle, you can avoid a tremendous amount of suffering and deprivation. And I have thought for a long time that that is the most urgently necessary piece of economic knowledge that the Austrian school has to share with the world. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. And it bears on practical policy. It bears on what the Fed is doing right now, how the Fed is just continues to pump tremendous amounts of money into the economy on a regular basis, month by month. And that is causing businesses to miscalculate, to produce the wrong things. It's also redistributing wealth arbitrarily, and in some cases, not so arbitrarily. Obviously, Wall Street's getting that new money first, which is going through the credit markets. So for people to understand a lot of things, the maldistribution of income and the cycle of employment and unemployment, the business cycle theory is crucial.
And of course, we endured this. I mean, we had a particularly severe case of a bust following one of these artificial booms back in 2008. And at that time, you really could count on one hand the number of, maybe two hands, the number of non-Austrian economists who predicted there were any problems. In fact, James Galbraith even said something like, I don't think you could find even a dozen economists who had been saying that there was anything really wrong. And yet, because we were equipped with this theory, we were able to step forward while the establishment flailed around and give people some guidance. And meanwhile, you had Paul Krugman, I'm not kidding, saying that we're way too focused on how we got here and not focused enough on how to get out. But how do you get out without knowing how you got there?
That's absolutely true. Yeah. So a number of Austrian economists, beginning, I would say, in 2003 or so, recognized that there was a housing bubble and recognized that when you have a bubble, it inevitably comes to an end. And when it does come to an end, there is tremendous suffering that results because of its effects on the real economy. That is, it's not just that houses had prices that were too high, but it was also the case that because interest rates were so low, businesses had invested in processes of production and capital goods that were really not profitable in the long run. They weren't serving the most urgent consumer demands. And when that adjustment was made, you would have a lot of unemployment, which we did have, and we had a very slow recovery.
I remember being in school and being told that physics was a closed system and that everything that there was to know about it, we pretty much had. So I wonder about, with Austrian economics, you read these amazing treatises, Human Action by Mises and Man, Economy, and State, and Huerta de Soto's book, and these huge, huge treatments of the whole expanse of the science. It might make somebody feel like, well, there's nothing further to say. It's already been said. Is that how you feel? Or if not, what are some avenues of research that seem fruitful to you?
Well, one avenue of research that I myself took up was that when the bubble occurred, the housing bubble occurred, and we had the tremendous financial crisis that followed it, I wrote an article showing how Austrian business cycle theory applies to that, because people were saying, well, Austrian business cycle theory doesn't apply because we know that when there's a depression, people's consumption falls off. And then that's not what's predicted by the business cycle theory. So in other words, they misconstrued Austrian business cycle theory and believed that it just caused overinvestment in capital goods. But what we saw, remember, in the run-up to 2006, was also people just using their houses as ATMs and just cashing out equity and spending like crazy on consumer goods. And that wasn't understood. How did that happen? So what I showed was that Austrians had already spoken about how when you have an inflation and profits and dividends are inflated and capital values of people's houses and the value of their 401ks, when those things are inflated, people are misled into thinking that they have more wealth than they really do. And so that's a false wealth effect that I incorporated into the Austrian business cycle theory. I mean, it was there, but it was never really drawn out. So I think that's important, that when new events occur, we apply the system that Rothbard and Mises wrote about, and we refine it and move it in different directions. So I think it is not a closed system by any means, because it talks about action, and action is never closed.
I think I read that paper when it was just an unpublished paper. I assume it eventually appeared in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics?
Yes, it did.
Okay, so I'll link to that because people really should read that article to make sure they have a full understanding of what the Austrians are saying about business cycles. And again, business cycles are, I mean, if you can understand what's causing them and if you can cure them, and I remember you saying once that, I don't know if you put it quite this way, but the article that maybe made you into an economist, maybe I'm overstating it, was Rothbard's article, Economic Depressions, Their Cause and Cure. At the very least, it had a big impact on you.
Oh, it did. That was the first Austrian work that I read. And, after taking two semesters of principles of macroeconomics and then intermediate macroeconomics, in 45 minutes that took me to read that pamphlet, I learned more about how the business cycle occurred, why it occurred, than I did in all of my macroeconomics classes that purported to explain the fluctuations in GDP.
Right. Well, there's also stuff that can be done these days. I know Guido Holtzmann is interested in the financial sector. And of course, there are financial innovations and things that could have an Austrian analysis applied. And there were a lot of people talking about derivatives at the time of the 2008 crash. And there's nothing in Human Action about that per se. So in that sense, there's certainly plenty to say. And then of course, there's cryptocurrency. So there are all these new developments that an Austrian could explore profitably, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
So of course, we don't want to just regurgitate Mises. We want to teach him, but we want to, as we say, when there are developments in our own world, we want to apply Austrian thinking to those. When you look to the rising generation of Austrian economists, do you feel confident about them?
Yes, because they are taking up the cudgels for, in defense of Austrian economics, and not just to defend it, but to advance it. So we have a lot of new and good work coming forth regarding entrepreneurship. In fact, Austrian economics now has a place in the management departments because the Austrians were the only ones that were really talking about entrepreneurs. So we're really the only ones that have a sort of a theoretical basis for management people to use to discuss the entrepreneur. So very excited about that. Peter Klein sort of started that movement. We have Matt McCaffrey and a number of others who have written important pieces on entrepreneurship from an Austrian perspective.
Can you take just a minute to explain, is there a way that the Austrians think about entrepreneurship that's different from the colloquial usage of the word entrepreneur?
Yeah, so when Austrians talk about entrepreneurship, the focus is on the uncertainty of the future. It's not on making massive new innovations starting from a static state, starting from some, you know, an unchanging economy, and suddenly someone has a bright idea and a great innovation, and they shake everything up. And those are the entrepreneurs, the innovators. Well, yeah, some of them are. But on the other hand, what's important is to continually make the minute and modest adjustments that are required as people's tastes change, as technology advances. Businesses and firms have to continually adjust production and pricing to these many, many, many changes that are going on. So the changes are occurring. We're not in a static economy. And entrepreneurship is a way of adjusting future production to those changes to make the best and most valuable use of our resources. So, you know, that might seem more mundane, but then again, it's no less important than breakthroughs like the iPhone and so on.
Right. These adjustments that go on every day are what make our standard of living what it is, because somebody has to make these adjustments. As you say, it seems like something mundane because not everything an entrepreneur does is, developing a rocket to take us to the moon. It doesn't have to be that glamorous, but it's crucial. Well, I want to know if somebody wants to jump in and read Mises. I sometimes feel like Mises has works that are, let's say for the absolute beginner, probably inaccessible, like Human Action. If you know some Austrian economics, you can read Human Action. I disagree that it's this impenetrable tome. I don't think it is really. But if you're an absolute beginner, I wouldn't send you there. But some of his, like, I'm trying to think of which little book I mean, but sometimes his little things are too simple. And so that sweet spot of intermediate Mises, I think has been filled, and I welcome your thoughts on this, by number one, Sean Rittenour's collection, The Mises Reader, which is a great introduction to Mises' writings. But secondly, Bob Murphy's book, Choice, which takes the Misesian framework and makes it, you know, maybe a little bit easier for the complete newbie to understand. What do you recommend in terms of reading?
For Mises himself, I think you have to read some of Mises. Economic Policy is a very simple book to read, but it shows the breadth of his thought. For a very good argument about or a way of sort of getting a view of how Mises thinks, I think his little book on bureaucracy is very good because that deals with the price system. It deals with business cycles. It deals with socialism. Even though it's a very short book, it really does kind of range over the breadth of his thought. And it's not a simplistic book. It's very straightforward and it's easy to read, but you gain a lot of knowledge there because he wrote that in 1944 towards the end of his very productive career. And he was sort of summing up, you know, all the things he had talked about regarding socialism, money, interventionism. So I do recommend Bureaucracy. And his great article, I have to put in a plug for his article, Profit and Loss, probably the best thing ever written on entrepreneurship and profit and loss.
Wow. Okay. I remember that was one of the first things I read by Mises because it was one of the, I don't know if it was required or recommended for Mises U back when I was a student. I read that. So, okay. So I'll try and remember. I'm going to try and put all these, you know, my memory isn't what it was, but I'll try and put all this stuff on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1984. Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BitTrust IRA. A lot of people have been putting crypto into their IRAs. And if you're thinking of doing the same thing, adding Bitcoin to your retirement account, the best way is through BitTrust IRA. The crypto world can be confusing. It's hard to know where to get started. These guys will help you. BitTrust IRA stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. And by the way, when they say nuclear bunkers, that isn't just hyperbole where they're saying it's really, really secure. We're actually talking about decommissioned nuclear bunkers. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. So how do you get started? Go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners. That's a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods. B-I-T-T-R-U-S-T trustira.com/woods. Now, obviously, what we're doing here is like we're just running through an overview just quickly for the curious layman. But while we're on this subject, the subject of Mises himself as a thinker has gone beyond the realm of the scholarly and become a source of contention, let's say, between people associated with the Mises Institute and some people who are critical of the Mises Institute. Now, most of those people are not scholars. I don't mean that no critics of the Mises Institute are scholars, but the kinds of people who say, you are besmirching the good name of Mises because he would never have agreed with your opinions on A, B, and C. Most of those are not scholars. You look through Mises' book, Socialism, and it turns out Mises was not actually a feminist after all. And he had very strong opinions on a wide array of moral questions, ranging from the family to abortion and to egalitarianism. And it turns out that people who say, well, you right-wing whatevers, you're not honoring Mises, I think they just don't know Mises that well, because don't forget, Mises sat on the editorial advisory board of the magazine of the John Birch Society. Is that the Mises you're talking to me about?
That's right.
Oh, they'll say Mises was a great cosmopolitan figure, and you guys are all terrible nationalists, which I don't even know where they get that, but they'll say that. Or the economists who came before Mises, they were all citizens of the world, and you're not like that, and so you're backward compared to Mises and his predecessors.
Well, both Mises and the classical economists who were free traders and who Mises esteemed very highly were nationalists. The reason why they supported free trade, and this is true of Mises, was because they were cosmopolitan in the following sense. They looked out to the world and saw that, based on economic theory, the prospering of one's own nation depends inextricably on the prospering of all other nations. Because as the market spreads and as nations abroad become more prosperous, they demand more and more goods from your nation. So the division of labor spreads over the whole world. And as we divide up labor and labor becomes more productive, all of us benefit. So this is what Mises meant by cosmopolitanism. He even says nationalism does not clash with cosmopolitanism because the nation, does not want war with its neighbors. It wants peace and friendly relations so as to strengthen the economic relation between nations.
I was very struck by the quotation from Lionel Robbins that you included in your article on this subject, where Lionel Robbins actually Lionel Robbins was an economist I read one of his books written in the 1930s, mm-hmm. but Robbins, who was far removed from the kinds of debates that, we have with critics today, nevertheless just came out as if anticipating these arguments and said, just speaking of the classical economists, that they were not opposed to nationalism because he says, if you look at the arguments they make for free trade, they're talking about nations. They're talking about this nation would do better if it concentrated in X, and this nation would do. They're thinking in terms of those categories and making these nations wealthier. It's Mises who then extends this reasoning to show that it's not just a matter of a country concentrating in one thing, but individuals concentrating in particular things. Even an individual who's better at everything than another individual still has a reason to want to interact with him. But it was very interesting to see Robbins say this. And incidentally, obviously, nationalism can be put to very, very bad and dangerous uses. Nobody denies that. But there are also innocent and harmless forms of nationalism that we might just call patriotism or attachment to the culture of one's country that Mises has no problem with at all.
Yeah, in fact, when Mises uses the word nation and nationalism, he really means nationality and something that a French liberal thinker called nationalitarianism. That is a love for one's culture. Nation in the European sense is really a cultural entity. And Mises even says that a nation is an organic entity and that men and women within the nation form a spiritual bond. I mean, he uses that word spiritual, and that nations cannot change in size because states change in size. In other words, if Germany conquers part of Poland and incorporates part of Poland, Polish-speaking people, that doesn't change the fact that there's one Polish nation with certain heritage and values and so on. And Rothbard recognizes that too. And I see no problem with nationalism in that sense. I mean, we're all born into a particular culture at a particular place and so on. And that's important, the idea that the individual is particular and all of his circumstances or her circumstances are.
Were you involved with the Mises Institute from the very beginning?
Indeed, I was, yes. I came to their first conference, which was on the gold standard in 1980.
Oh, gosh, I think I've seen your hair in that at that time. Okay. All right, well, you were a man of your time, you know, as we all were. We all had hair like that.
So. Yes.
Okay. Okay, well, I guess, can you just, as we draw to a close,
yes.
What is the Mises Institute, which has been around since, I guess, 1982?
Yes.
What was it seeking to accomplish? It's not seeking what a traditional think tank wants to do, which is to be in Washington, D.C. and try to have influence within the corridors of power. That doesn't work. It really doesn't. The corridors of power do not care about your little policy study. So then what is the goal of the Mises Institute?
Well, the Mises Institute was built on the insight that ideas have consequences. That, as Mises says, wherever people meet, public opinion is forming. So whenever you're communicating with anyone about anything, public opinion is in the process of continually forming and changing. So what the Mises Institute was set up to do was, first of all, to offset a movement that began in the 1970s to downplay, late 1970s, to downplay Mises' thought and to say, well, you know, he was a bit intolerant, you know, he was brilliant, but he was a bit intolerant, uncompromising, and so that his student Hayek was the one that we should really promote. So Lew Rockwell and Murray Rothbard were the main proponents of having an institute in which Mises' ideas were played up and given their proper due. So to put those two things together, basically the Mises Institute wants to educate people in the thought of Mises and his followers like Murray Rothbard and the people who have come later.
And of course, I think it's at least a two-pronged approach because it does want to educate the general public. But it also wants to raise up, because no one else is going to do it if we don't, the next generation of Austrian economists. And they come through that summer program, the Mises University program that I first went to in 1993, that's still going strong now. You should seriously consider, I mean, people who are, if you're a college student, sometimes an especially precocious high school student manages to sneak in. It is very, very much worth your time. So I'll post, of course, Mises.org is the website, Mises.org, but it's every July at the Mises Institute. You should look for the details at Mises.org/events and do whatever it takes to get there, is my advice. So whatever closing thought you have about Mises, Joe, we will certainly welcome, and then we'll wrap it up.
Well, Mises is still worth reading today. He's probably the greatest economist of the 20th century. I mean, his thought resonates. Again, I'll go back and just recommend works like Profit and Loss and Bureaucracy for those who want to start. And even his little book, Economic Policy. He's a very straightforward writer. He's a passionate writer. And he's also a scientist. And this is how scientists communicate with the public at large.
All right. All those links will be up at tomwoods.com/1984. And anytime I forget to include a link, boy, do I hear about it in the comments. So don't worry. All this stuff will be there on that show notes page. Joe, thanks so much for your time today and for your insights.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure, Tom.
All right, folks, we're getting very, very close to the 2000th episode of the Tom Woods Show. We're going to be recording that at a big event in Orlando, October 16th, 2021. And it's going to just be a couple of hours, probably more, well, certainly more, of hilarity and fun. And it costs you nothing to attend. But what I do want to emphasize is that it says on the event page, tomwoods2000.com, that we're starting at 8 p.m. We're starting at 8 p.m. sharp. So get there early so you can get a parking space, get inside the building, get your bearings, find the ballroom, sit down. You don't want to be running around while this thing's going on. So get there a little bit early because when that clock strikes 8 p.m., we are starting right on the dot because I have a lot of stuff I want to include before the resort throws us out. So we want to make sure and get all that in there. You can show up really early, by the way, and get a bite to eat there. I think they have like 14 restaurants at this resort, so you won't go hungry. That's for sure. Now, speaking of eating, by the way, for those of you who will be at the reception for supporting listeners. By the way, I've had to declare that sold out. Nobody else can be added into that at this point. The numbers are insane. I can't possibly add anybody else. So if you haven't signed up for the reception for paid supporters, then I'm afraid you're going to have to wait to the 3,000th episode for that. Obviously, the main event is open and available to everybody for free, but the reception beforehand, the numbers are overwhelming and we've had to declare it to be sold out. But remember that this is not a dinner. We had a dinner 4 years ago at the 1,000th episode, but I've gone out of my way to say a reception. This is not a dinner. So you need to eat beforehand or you're going to be very unhappy and uncomfortable all through the 2,000th episode. Eat something, then come to the reception, then meet me for the main event. So that's my advice to you. All right, everybody, looking forward to that. Let's hope nothing goes terribly wrong. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.